Moa is here. Thank you, Senator, for being with us this afternoon. Senator Erickson Robes will be joining us pretty soon, and we will see what other senators will be here this afternoon. We have several conflicts. Unfortunately, we schedule the Poverty Commission meeting this afternoon, the Veterans Committee meeting this afternoon, another committee, so we're trying to do our best. We're in different rooms meeting at the same time talking about different topics. So, and many of us co-chair these committees, and so unfortunately we didn't realize that we had created this conflict for ourselves. But we will do our best to share the information with the rest of the group, and hopefully we will have some other members joining us pretty soon. And I apologize in advance. You will see some people leaving the table, others coming in. This afternoon, we are going to hear from Mr. Carlos Valverde, who is the Senior Education Policy Specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Really appreciate that he came all the way to Minnesota to give us an overview of what is happening nationwide, but also to really do an analysis, and he did this for us in the state, to really look at Minnesota and compare Minnesota with other states. So thank you, Mr. Valverde, for doing that for us. And after his presentation, we are going to hear from the McKenzie Group. Probably many of you are aware of the committee that was put in place to work to develop the strategic planning process for the Minneapolis School District. They have finished their recommendations, and we are very excited about the outcome of that group, and particularly because a lot of input from the community was gathered in order to come up with those recommendations. So they will be here to give you a very brief overview. They will have meetings in the community, so you will hear more information, more in-depth information about that report. And finally, we will have the State of Minnesota State Councils of Color, which will provide an overview of the current status of children of color in the state of Minnesota and their concerns about achievement gap and their goals for working together to address these issues. Mr. Valverde, thank you so much for being here, and we are ready for your presentation. Yes.
Pick it up. Well, yeah, my name is Carlos Valverde. I work for an organization called the National Conference of State Legislatures. And NCSL is a bipartisan organization that serves all 50 legislatures and all the territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, the Virgin Islands. We do educational research. We actually cover every policy issue imaginable. We have a staff of about 250. We do energy, environment, transportation, healthcare, all policy issues. I happen to work in the education program. We do summits, we do conferences, and we really try to provide a forum for states to develop innovative public policy. Today, I'm going to be talking about the achievement gap, and I'm going to be focusing on three main areas. And it's kind of going to be overviewed on this idea of improving the educational pathway for all students, but especially students of color. And we're going to look at rigor, relationship, and resources, the three R's. These are becoming very common among education policy folks, these three R's. And I want to start off by telling you a little bit about myself. When I started thinking about the educational pathway, I couldn't help but remember back to when I first started high school, and I'll admit I was a bit of a knucklehead coming out of middle school. I ditched all the time. I barely did enough to pass my classes, gotten a bunch of fights. I was a little bit of a scrapper back then, and suspended a number of times. But my high school counselor seen a little spark in me and said, "You know what? I believe in this kid." And he was actually my wrestling coach, and he said, I want this kid to do something in his life. So I remember the second week of high school, he pulled me out of class and he said, "I want you to go to this presentation for a program called Upward Bound." Anyone ever heard of Upward Bound? Okay, yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with Upward Bound, it's a college access program for low-income and so-called at-risk students. And that pretty much described me. At-risk is a pretty accurate term to describe me at that time. And I was sitting in this presentation, and honestly, I really wasn't interested at all in what the presenter was talking about. This was a great opportunity. I was just happy to be out of class, right? Being out of class was more important to me than what was going on. And there was this little Chicana sitting next to me, very pretty girl. And so I kept talking to her and trying to get her phone number and not paying attention at all to the presentation. So as the presentation led out, I was walking out of the auditorium, and I got a tap on my shoulder. I turned around, and it was that presenter. And he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, "Hey, homie, what college are you going to go to?" No one had ever asked me that before. No one ever asked me what college I was going to go to. So he caught me a little bit off guard. But remember, I was kind of a knucklehead, and I was a bit of a smart mouth. So I said the first thing that came to my mind. I looked at him, and I said, "I'm going to Colorado College, homie." The amazing thing was that after I said that, that man, Chaz Maldonado, without even blinking an eye, he said, "That's right, homie, you're going to go to Colorado College." He said it so convincingly that I began to believe it. I was like, uh-oh, maybe I am going to go to Colorado College. He must have seen the panic in my eyes, because at that moment, he handed me an application to Upper Bound and said, "I can help you get there." That was my first step in realizing there is this educational pathway. But for many students, it's not happening like that. The good news is, though, that college entrance rates for all students have gone up over the last 25 years. These are all students, well, actually not all students, white, black, and Latino students. We can see that in 1976, all three groups started at about the same college-going rate for high school graduates. But more recently, we've seen a fairly large gap emerge. When we look at the sort of outcome of that, when we look at 25-year-olds who have a bachelor's degree in this country, well, that gap is even larger. And we're even beginning to see a gap grow between the Latino population and the African-American population. This is a little bit concerning. You know, one of the things that Chaz did with me in that first meeting with him is he set a very high educational expectation. He said, "That's right, homie, you're going to go to Colorado College." And at the time, all I knew was that Colorado College was supposedly the best college in Colorado. That's what I'd been told. I didn't know any better. So that brings me to my first R, rigor. A study done by the U.S. Department of Education looked at all college graduates, and they found that on average, most students, this is where their graduation rates fall out. Not very good for African-American and Latino students. But then they looked at the top 40% of graduates according to GPA. It went up a little bit, but not really for Latino students. Then they looked at those who scored high on the SAT or ACT. And as you would suspect, those students tended to graduate college at a little bit higher rate as well. But then they looked at the top 40% in terms of their curriculum. And those students did even better. So what this study found is that above class rank, above GPA, above test scores, the curriculum that a student takes is the best predictor of their chances of graduating from college, of getting a bachelor's degree. So we know that rigor is important. And it's especially important for African-American and Latino students. It had three times the impact for these students than it did for white students. Unfortunately, though, nationally, only about 20% of Latinos and 23% of black students take a rigorous college curriculum. I would even argue that that 40% for white students is unacceptable. But as you know, like in Minnesota, like in many other states, this academic preparedness gap does not start in high school. It starts much earlier. This is a distribution of scores on the NAEP reading for white fourth graders by state. And let's take a look at where Minnesota ranks. Near the top, you all are doing pretty well with this category. What I want you to pay particular attention to, and I'm hoping you all can see it on your handouts, I want you to pay particular attention to the very worst state and educating white students. And I'm going to highlight that. They're scoring right under 220. Okay, they're scoring right under 220. This is the same chart for Latino students, all states. 220 was the number for the very worst state. For Latino students, the very best state is about 220. And where does Minnesota fall? At the bottom of the country. When we take a look at eighth graders in math, well, Minnesota is doing excellent. Number one in the country. Congratulations. That's awesome. Let's again take a look at the worst country, worst state in the country. Right about 270. For African-American eighth graders in math, the best state, under 270. And Minnesota, more towards the middle. The interesting thing about the NAEP, for those of you who are familiar with NAEP, it's called a vertically aligned assessment. And what that means is that we can equate these test scores to an actual grade. Okay? And it's for every 10 points in gap is a grade level of learning. And on this particular slide, we're seeing a 30-point gap between white students and African-American students in Minnesota. That means 3-grade-level difference in Minnesota. I looked at the NAEP scores on all categories, and Minnesota either ranks number 1, number 2, occasionally number 5, one time number 9 in the gap between students of color and white students. Cumulatively, that means Minnesota has the largest achievement gap in the country between white students and students of color. There is some good news. I don't want to be doom and gloom. There is some good news. For those students in Minnesota who are ambitious and go and take the SAT, this is a college entrance exam, they're actually doing fairly well, and the gap isn't that large. In fact, for all ethnic groups in Minnesota, for those ambitious students at least, the gap is small, and they're all scoring above 950, which is the general benchmark for being academically prepared to start at a 4-year university without academic remediation. So on average, your ambitious students are achieving that. That's excellent. But what I want you to pay particular attention to is this little note up here on top. And that says that Latinos, African Americans, and Native Americans only represent about 6% of all the test takers of the SAT. Yet they represent 15%, a little bit over 15% of the total population. So there's a huge gap there. And when we look at high school achievement in Minnesota, this is from your Minnesota assessment, we see significant gaps, over 200 points in reading, 10th grade reading, about 150 points on 11th grade math. So these gaps are prevalent, they're persistent, and they're a big concern. So what are some of the things you can do to, these are some ideas that I've found in other states that seem to be effective on improving rigor and this academic achievement in states. And the first one there is to set high expectations earlier. You all have put a lot of investment in early childhood education, and I applaud you for that. And I believe that with that investment, you're going to see results. The only thing is you're not going to see results right away. Investments in early childhood education take a while, but what we do know from those communities who have instituted quality early childhood education, they do reduce the gaps that are seen later on by students of color and low-income students. They do reduce those gaps. But we need to make sure that all these things are aligned. Research shows that for eighth graders, if they can take algebra in the eighth grade, their chances of getting a college degree doubles. We need to make that the standard then. All students should have eighth grade algebra, but we need to make sure that they're prepared before that. One of the other things I noticed in Minnesota is that the graduation requirements for the various districts are not necessarily aligned with your college admissions requirements. Some of the districts in Minnesota only require 2 years of math, but your flagship institutions require a minimum of 3 for admissions. You need to take a look at that. That means that some districts are not giving students the minimum requirements to be qualified for your higher ed institutions. One of the forums that issues like this can be addressed is in the P20 councils. And you need to pressure your P20 councils to look at these things and talk to the districts, talk to the superintendents, talk to those local school boards, because I know local control is very important in Minnesota. So we need to get their buy-in and we need to have them sitting on these P20 councils. For students who are behind, it's often not enough to give them more homework. They may go home to environments that aren't conducive to doing homework. Homework is important and they need to do that, but we need to make sure they have extended learning opportunities so that if they don't have a home environment to complete those assignments, there is some environment for them. And extended opportunities doesn't necessarily mean after school programs. Some states have extended the school year, extended the school day, or have even instituted year-round schooling for students who are at very high risk. And all these things seem to have some impact. Another one is to increase that academic rigor is make available things like AP, Advanced Placement, International Baccalaureate, dual and concurrent enrollment legislation has also helped. Is everyone familiar with dual enrollment legislation? This is where a student who is in high school can also be enrolled in college courses at the same time. These in Colorado, we have what we call fast tracks. And it's sort of a 3-2 program where a student will spend 3 years in high school, 2 years in college, and then at the end they get a high school diploma. So they spend a total of 5 years, they get a high school diploma and an associate's degree. This is actually saving Colorado money because traditionally an associate's degree would have taken 6 years, but now it's only taking 5 for some students. This is saving them money. And for those students who are not interested in college, but are more interested in a trade or some sort of technical education, this is a real benefit to them. Another thing, especially for students of color, we need to let them understand that they're valued in our institutions. We might consider providing credit for Black history, for Latino literature, for these cultural classes that really value their culture. And then once we show them that's credit, then they begin to feel like, you know what? This institution values us. Maybe we do belong here. I'm not going to go through this slide. Basically, what it says is rigor, academics are important, but they're not everything. Relationships matter too. And one of the most important relationships between for students is that between the student and the teacher. You know, ultimately, I was accepted into that program, Upward Bound, and I spent 4 years of high school in Upward Bound, and every time I saw that guy, Chaz Maldonado, every time I seen him, he would say, "What's up, Colorado College? How you doing, Colorado College?" He called me Colorado College for 4 years. What Chaz was doing with me was, again, establishing that relationship based on a very high educational expectation. He never let me forget that goal of Colorado College. Relationships do matter, and the one between the student and the teacher is supreme. This is a study done in the Dallas Independent School District, and they looked at two groups of students that started at roughly the same level in third grade math. So they started third grade. One group was at the 55th percentile. The other group was at the 57th percentile. Group one was given 3 what they call effective teachers. Group 2 was given 3 what they describe as ineffective teachers. Group 1, their numbers increased from the 55th to the 76th percentile in just 3 years. Group 2 dropped from the 57th to the 20th percentile in just 3 years. The net result of that is nearly a 50-point difference with 3 consecutive effective teachers. Teachers matter. But unfortunately, minority kids and poor kids receive far less effective teachers than white students. The green bars are how many what they describe as inexperienced teachers. These are teachers with less than 3 years experience that minority students receive compared to white students. Almost double. Minority students nationally are receiving almost double. These are classes that are taught by out-of-field teachers. Again, the green bar is poor and minority students. In Minnesota, That gap is almost triple. Almost triple. Now, I couldn't find the data for districts of color or schools of color. And I'm not sure why exactly the data wasn't pulling for me in Minnesota, but I'm going to go back and try to figure that out. But for you all, this is a question you might want to ask your Department of Ed. How many of our teachers are described as inexperienced or teaching out of field, and how many of them are teaching in high concentrations of kids of color? That's a good question for you all to ask.
Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
Pardon me, I'm not familiar with the terminology of out of field. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, out of field means that they don't have a degree in the subject that they're teaching, or they don't have a certification in the subject that they're teaching. So oftentimes a science teacher may be teaching math classes at a middle school, or vice versa, or sometimes it's the English teacher teaching math classes. I was just told I have 10 minutes. I'm going to skip through some of this stuff. Risk factors, here's a brief overview of these risk factors. Minority students are much more likely to be suspended, much more likely to drop out, much more likely to be identified as mentally retarded, having a learning disability, or having an emotional disturbance. And of course, they're much less likely to be identified as gifted and talented. You have these recommendations. The one thing I want to emphasize here is that teachers matter, so do parents, so do community members. When we think about what we can do to improve teaching quality, we have to remember that teachers, like all other professionals, can become better. They can become better with development, with professional development, with proper training, with experience, with mentoring. They can become better. So we don't want to give up on our teachers. Our teachers are doing good work. And so we want to make sure we value the work that they do. But we do want to make sure we're investing in those teachers and making sure they have all the resources that they need. One of the real key ways of doing that is making sure our universities are properly preparing our teachers to teach students of color and students in high poverty areas. And not only that, but that they're training students from those communities to go back and become teachers. The one thing I will caution you with, though, is that in the training of students of colors or students who come out of high poverty situations, is that they do not do their teacher training in those communities. A lot of times when they come out of those communities, they don't have this concept of high expectations, of rigorous curriculum. And so when they come back, they become very average teachers like they had when they were students. We need to make sure that they're being trained in very high achieving environments so that they can take that culture of high achieving and implant it in those schools. Some other things that we can do to attract good teachers, of course, pay is always an incentive. Some states are considering low interest loans for housing, various ways to attract and retain these teachers. But we need to make sure that we're incentivizing them to stay in hard to staff schools where there are large numbers. You can also require that schools outreach to parents or provide technical assistance to schools who want to increase their parent involvement. Students need a caring adult in their lives. And without that, we see a lot of development of those risk factors. That brings me to my last point here is on resources. And relationships and rigor matter, but resources, money matters too. These are some words from Katie Haycock, who's one of my heroes in this field. She's with the Education Trust, and you know, she really highlights that in some states like New Jersey, they've really invested in high poverty schools. Indiana has really invested in students of color to make sure that this educational pathway is more equitable for them. But as a country, we actually spend $800 less on average per pupil on low-income school districts. Here's some spending numbers. On average, this is the low-income. This is the low-income chart. In Minnesota, you all are actually doing very well. Right up there with some of the best in the country. Massachusetts, you're even ahead of Massachusetts, which is usually considered the model for school reform. You're doing better than them. Not quite as good as New Jersey, but better than Indiana, who has done an excellent job in school reform. But when we look at minority concentrated populations, well, Minnesota's not doing as good a job, doing much better than the national average. I do want to point that out, because nationally it's about $900 less that the country gives per minority student. Minnesota gives about $900 more. That's good. But there are severe disparities in Minnesota. Like I said, in my opinion, the largest disparities are happening in Minnesota. And this gap, there's a difference here between Minnesota and New Jersey of about $800. That's pretty significant per pupil. Because for an average high school, average size high school of 1,500 students, $800 per student would result in $1.1 million that Minnesota high school students don't receive that New Jersey high school students do. And for the disparities in Minnesota, we need to really begin to ask, are we investing enough? That's the high school graduation rates for Minnesota. Again, the largest disparity in the country. Only about 40% of students of color, African American, Latino, and Native American students are graduating on time in Minnesota. The interesting thing that I found when for all the data, when I disaggregated it by gender, males of color, even lower. And I happened to take a look at the incarceration rate in Minnesota. I didn't include this slide, but for males of color, as their achievement has dropped, the incarceration rate has skyrocketed. That graduation rate looks awful similar to the median household income. Let me go back real quick. We see that white students are very high and students of color are very low. Household incomes, white families tend to be very high. Students of color tend to come from lower income families. Home ownership rates looks the same. Children of color are 3 times more likely to live in poverty. We cannot separate poverty and race. They are so intertwined that one oftentimes is a direct correlation to the other. And it's very hard to disaggregate those things. And this is important because when we look at educational outcomes, it becomes very sad for low-income students. This chart right here shows us high school or college entrance rates based on achievement and income. So what we see here is that high income students, so rich students, the very wealthiest of students and the very highest achieving students go to college at about 97%. Well, that makes sense. For the smartest low achieving students, only 78% are going to college. But what I want to point out here is that there's these two numbers. The highest income kids, lowest achieving, go to college at about 77%. Basically, what this slide tells us is that the dumbest rich kids in this country, the dumbest rich kids, go to college at about the same rate as our smartest poor kids. That's unfortunate. So in Minnesota, ultimately, we see an educational pipeline that looks like this for our students. Black students start out at 8% of the K-12 population. They drop to 7, drop to 3 at the 4-year colleges. And in the end, only 2% of the bachelor degrees awarded in this state go to black students. For Latinos, it drops 5, 2, 1. And it's actually, I rounded up that bachelor degree percentage. It's actually 0.8. 0.8% of the bachelor degrees go to Latino students in this state. But when we look at white students, they actually see a little upcrease when it comes to bachelor degree attainment. They start out at 79, but ultimately end up as 80% of the bachelor degrees. The one thing you'll notice is that these bachelor degrees numbers don't add up to 100%. And that's because Minnesota has a significant number of foreign students that I didn't include on this chart. So some of the things you can do to improve your resource allocation is, one, to examine your school funding formula. I will say that even though Minnesota has a very equitable funding formula, sometimes that equitable is lost in district averaging. Sometimes a district will have, on one end of the district, have a very wealthy school that has incredible resources, and then across town is a very poor school with not so much resources. But averaging them by district, it seems to wash out, and we see a very high district average there. So we need to look more school-based. Early aid commitments have been a wonder in states like Indiana and Oklahoma. Early aid commitments are guarantees to students very early in their school years. In Indiana, it's in the sixth grade, and they go to every sixth grader and say, every low-income sixth grader, and say, hey, if you take a rigorous high school curriculum, if you don't get suspended from school, if you do these certain things, when you graduate from high school, we will pay for your entire college education. These incentives are helpful. The one thing I will caution you, though, is that making a guarantee to a student in the sixth grade, when that student, like when I was in sixth grade, when they were being pressured to smoke marijuana or get jumped into the gang, you forget those commitments. You forget those commitments when social pressures begin to play on you. So think about how you can integrate these incentives to students all along the way. Wouldn't it be nice if we could start a student account when they were born and say, hey, if you continuate from the fifth grade to middle school, we're going to give you another $3,000 in this account. If you pass your seventh grade state assessment with a score of proficiency, we're going to give you another $1,000 in this account. And you check in with them every time. Give them benchmarks all along the way. That'll keep it in their mind constantly that we expect high things from them. I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. Many states are looking at ways to increase their investment in financial aid, because we know financial aid is important. But many states are going towards merit-based aid rather than need-based aid. And what we saw from the last chart that I just showed is that wealthy families are sending their kids to college even without the aid. It's the low-income families that really need the help. They're the ones who are not going to college. And then another idea, I know the Latino population has really grown in Minnesota, and it continues to grow. And a lot of that population is undocumented. And these students sometimes have to pay significant amounts more for higher education. And then they begin to see that education really isn't something that's for them, because there is no pathway for them. It's virtually exclusive in many instances. They can't afford those higher state tuition rates. So an idea is to form some sort of way to make it more affordable for those students. There is a fourth R here that I didn't include at all, but it is important, and that's relevance. We need to make sure that students feel some sort of connectedness to the school, that there is an outcome at the end for them. So we need to make sure that all these things are connected. Economics, health, all these things are connected. And so we need to make sure that at the end, if they put in all this work, there is some sort of benefit for them. And so we need to make sure it's relevant. This is my contact information. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to the next presenter. Thank you for listening to me. And Senator, thank you for inviting me to Minnesota. It was very interesting for me to look at what's going on here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Valverde. I would like to ask Senator Mua if you have questions for Mr. Valverde, and then I would like to open for two questions from the audience. So if I could take two questions, that would be great.
Thank you.
Senator Mua.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Valverde, thank you for your time and for coming all the way to Minnesota. Can you give us a little bit of an update on where the National Conference of State Legislatures is on the out-of-state tuition for undocumented students issue?
Sure. We don't take any position on legislation at the state level, but we have taken a position at the federal level with the DREAM Act. And we have a lobbyist who works out of our D.C. office, and we have passed a position to support the DREAM Act. And it's interesting, though, because it's not for the traditional reasons that you would think, that because it's the right thing to do or these students deserve access to higher education. We decided to support the DREAM Act because we believe in states' rights to set their own tuition policies. So whatever the state, we think this is preemption by the federal government to say a state cannot provide in-state tuition. And we actually questioned the legality of the federal government being able to do that. So for those states who have passed in-state tuition legislation, we support them in their right to do that.
Thank you.
Good question.
My second question is, I'd like to go back to page 16 of your presentation.
Can you remind me the slide? Because I don't have those pages.
To get there. You were talking about the minority districts. You were looking at per pupil funding.
Mm.
The first slide was highest versus lowest poverty districts. And then the per pupil funding, highest versus lowest minority districts. And right. You had there listed Minnesota. And I don't know if you have had a chance to look at the data that put this slide together. But how do you determine a minority district in Minnesota or any of the other states?
This data comes from the Education Trust.
Okay.
And they put out a booklet every year called Funding Gaps, and they look at state funding formulas and they calculate all these things. And the way they identify a high minority school district is greater than 25% minorities in that district.
And then, Madam Chair, if you would indulge me for one last question, and maybe the answer is obvious, But in the first and throughout, actually, when you were looking at comparison of the students, in particular the students of color, Asian students are left off the chart. And I just wondered if that was they're not relevant in the numbers and looking at the students of color, or what was the reason for that?
That's an excellent question. Generally, what we see in most states is that Asian students are actually performing higher than white students. A couple of exceptions are Minnesota and a few others like Alaska and places where they're very, very small percentages of Asian students. Minnesota is one of the only states where Asian students are actually performing significantly lower than white students. One of the reasons why I didn't include them is sometimes I don't have the data available because the population is very small. So it's either not available to me or sometimes as a researcher, data is... you have to get access to certain Department of Ed data. I don't have access to it all.
Well, Madam Chair, let me do a follow-up.
Because sure.
This is sort of your area of expertise, right?
Yes.
And so is it what I was hearing you state was that sometimes there is no information on data on Asian
mm-hmm.
students.
Yeah.
Does that raise a concern for those of you who work in this area that you don't have that kind of comparative information?
It does. In fact, for Minnesota, there are several points where we don't have data. Another one is on Native American students. You'll notice that many of the slides don't include Native American students. And so what I would encourage Minnesota to do is continue to oversample in their data collections of those populations. Because it's hard. It's hard for a researcher to then go to the data and try to create some sort of analysis when the data is just not there. Or the sample size isn't large enough for us to do that. Another population that is foreign students. And I kept noticing that there were this group of other categories. And I'm suspecting that it's a pretty significant foreign population in Minnesota. I don't know that to be the case. But it sounds, just from looking at the data with that category of other all the time, it looks like that population is fairly significant. So we may want to begin oversampling in terms of like Hmong. I don't know who all, what the ethnic breakdown are here, but oversampling is always positive for researchers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Valverde. I believe that the McKinsey group is ready, and because we're running out of time, I apologize, but we have to move to the next presentation so that you can hear the entire presentation. Thank you. And Mr. Valverde will be here, of course, for those of you who wish to ask questions. At the end, we will gather over here. So thank you. Thank you, Carlos.
Do they have a presentation?
Yes. Do you have a PowerPoint presentation that you need to put in the computer? And I also want to invite members of the audience to move over here, if I know it's kind of hard to This room is not a very good room for these presentations. I apologize for that. There is some space over here. If you wish to move to this end of the room, it might be. And we can maybe put that screen back a little bit so that they can see it. Try to do that.
What is that? The screen back?
Just a little bit, I think. Yeah, just a little bit, I think, will help. So that this group. Great. Thank you for coming. We really appreciate that you are here. This is a great opportunity for us to hear a presentation that, in my view, is becoming more and more relevant to the state of Minnesota. This particular report that was put together by the McKinsey Group really highlights a district, the Minneapolis School District. But as I review the statistics and as you heard the statewide perspective that was provided by Mr. Valverde, it becomes clear and clearer that this is an issue that affects the entire state of Minnesota, that we need to deal with the achievement gap and the numbers from a statewide perspective. What I think is very important about this particular report and what you're going to hear in a few minutes is that the McKinsey Group was able to do a very in-depth analysis of a district that really helped us look at specific issues like cross-subsidy, the revenue issues, and also the students. And because we have higher numbers of students of color in this particular district, it becomes a little bit easier to address the very question that Senator Mua had a few minutes ago with respect to how do we really do comprehensive analysis if we don't really have the numbers. And that's what happens when we go statewide and nationwide. So welcome, and I would like to ask you to please introduce yourselves.
Great. It's an honor to be here. I'm Doug Scott, and I'm with McKinsey & Company.
And I'm David Hale, and I'm with McKinsey & Company as well.
So what we want to do today, it's an honor to be here. Our purpose tonight, this afternoon, is to share with you the recommendations that we've made to the Minneapolis Public Schools with the goal of driving achievement and closing the achievement gap. What I want to do is briefly describe the process we used to get to these recommendations, highlight the goal that we think should be driving the effort, briefly provide some context around the current situation, but then focus most of our time on the recommendations that we've put forth to the Minneapolis Public Schools. Hoping that after our brief time here this afternoon, you feel updated on the plan that we've put forth and that MPS is in the process of considering and excited about the direction that MPS is about to embark on. So with that, by the way, I think we've given you a full document which reflects what we've presented to the board. This is slightly abbreviated given the time, but we want to make sure you knew that even though they don't match, you have everything in front of you and then some. So the objective of the work was to develop a strategic agenda to ensure that every child could get an excellent public education through the Minneapolis Public Schools. And in doing that, we spent a lot of time gathering input. So we had student focus groups, parent focus groups, and a very long list of things, including surveys, community interviews, interviews with research experts in the field, in the areas of research. And we then used the Board of Education staff at MPS, and we also had a strategic advisory group, which included business leaders, teachers, principals, community members. Senator Ray was on that group as well, and worked with that team as we did our research, looked at the facts of the district to drive forth and come forward with our recommendations. And as you can imagine, to get a good answer in this situation, it was important for us to encourage dissent And we certainly did get a lot of that. That said, the strategic advisory group is 80 to 90% aligned with the recommendations that we put forth to the board on Tuesday. We're very pleased with that. And I'll highlight as we go a couple of the recommendations that we did have some disagreement amongst the strategic advisory group on. So in doing this, we think it's crucial that the district have an overarching goal to drive tough decisions and to inspire the type of change that's required to close the gap in Minneapolis. The vision is that every child should be college ready. Whether or not they choose to go to college, they should have the skills and abilities to make that decision, whether they decide to pursue a four-year degree or to go to community college, pursue a trade. We think those skills are required upon finishing high school in this day and age. We also set a very aggressive goal that by 2012, 80% of Minneapolis public school students will score proficient or higher on the MCA math and reading tests, that 80% of all MPS students reach a threshold score on a college entrance exam, such as the ACT, and that the race and income achievement gaps are reduced by 75%. This may not be the specific goal that MPS uses to drive their effort going forward, but we thought it important to put one out there to show how critical it is, how time-phased it needed to be, and how measurable it needed to be. It has to be specific so that we can all track how we're doing on a year-by-year basis against the goal. It's very aggressive, but we think there are reasons that MPS can succeed. First of all, there are many great assets to build on. There's excellent staff, and there are some high-performing schools in the district. There are a legion of diehard parents and other supporters that we had an opportunity to meet with and talk with throughout the 6 months we spent on this project. The board has been willing to make some tough decisions, and that will continue going forward. The leadership team that's been brought in is committed to moving aggressively. And of course, we have a diverse global student population with unlimited potential, and we really need to make the most of that. Furthermore, other schools and districts are raising achievement despite similar challenges and diverse populations. And a window of opportunity exists right now to act decisively and inspire dramatic change. The district has recognized the challenge. There are a lot of folks pulling in the right direction, and now is a great time to do this. These issues aren't unique to Minneapolis. They'll resonate, but one of the things that I think it's important to start with, as one of the board members said on Tuesday, the first step to improving is recognizing the problem, and MPS leadership has certainly not shied away from talking about the tough truths. So I want to highlight those briefly for you today. First, less than half of Minneapolis public school children are meeting the Minnesota standards in reading and math. Many MPS graduates who do graduate, which is about 67% of them who go to college, still need remediation, and that's true of all of the high schools. So these are the kids that go on to a Minneapolis educational institution need at least one or more remediation course, even though they've graduated from the high schools in Minneapolis public schools. Students of color can and do achieve, but Minneapolis public schools is currently not getting the job done. And this is the achievement gap we're talking about. You can see where the state average is. You can see where Minneapolis overall is. But that average hides a really dramatic gap between all of the populations, especially pronounced amongst our African-American and American Indian populations when compared to the Caucasian students. So we think this is a huge focus. There's no way the district can get to this 80% achievement goal without really closing this gap almost entirely. Furthermore, some of the communities have little faith in the district. Of the parents that leave, 40% say they left because they're worried about the future quality of education offered by MPS. And families of color specifically cited not feeling welcome, believing that their kids were treated unfairly. And we heard stories in our focus groups of some negative, culturally insensitive interactions with staff. So this is obviously a concern for us going forward. To make matters even more challenging, the financial situation is grim. There's a projected $100 million shortfall. The reserves are low and will be used to cover this in the short term. And 23% of this revenue stream is vulnerable, whether it be due to the referendum, compensatory, and integration aid. So this is an optimistic situation scenario, assuming that those things all stay in place. We also have seen a pronounced decline in enrollment in Minneapolis. And the other thing, this is not only expected to continue, but we know that a good number of students, about 5,000 students or more, are currently in public charter schools in Minneapolis as they've left the system. We know from our analysis that these charter schools are as varied in their performance as the schools in Minneapolis. So the kids are leaving, but not necessarily for options that are better than the current situation in Minneapolis public schools. So these are the tough truths. The other thing we noticed in our work and want to highlight here today is the barriers to getting these changes accomplished, and they are significant and require action. First and foremost, across the district, staff are not measured on student results, so no one is accountable. Poor performing principals and teachers are shuffled around the district while new stars are not retained. Principals are not able to build and lead their own teams. Some staff have low expectations of students and do not see families as partners. There's ineffective and inconsistent application of behavior strategies in the district. There's inconsistent acceptance of curricula and instructional strategies. Unfunded mandates and subsidies cause financial problems and shortchange MPS students. And an antiquated schooling model, which was designed more for the 1950s than today, is trying to serve a very different population with more challenges, different needs, and different expectations for competing in a global economy. What I want to do now is highlight the things that we saw drove achievement when we look at our research. I'll do these briefly, but I think they provide good context for where the recommendations came from. First and foremost, and not surprisingly, is that teachers are most important. But what is surprising is how important a great teacher is. If you take a student in the 50th percentile and you give them a great teacher for 3 straight years, they end up in the 90th percentile. And that's controlling for economic background, everything else in the equation apart from the teacher. The teacher drives this much of a difference. That same student ends up with a teacher that is a low-performing teacher, and they end up 3 years later in the 37th percentile. So this is a 53 percentile point gap between the same student having an excellent teacher and having an ineffective teacher. And we think this is crucial, and you'll see this play very heavily into our recommendations. Now, also not surprising is that principals play the second most vital role in driving achievement. Mm-hmm. When principals are allowed to focus on instruction and given the opportunity to, achievement gains are significant. In Jefferson County, Kentucky, they were able to take a lot of the administrative time off of the administrative tasks off the principal's plate and effectively double the time that that principal was able to spend on instruction. As a result, they went from seeing 2.4 percentage point gains each year to a 5% gain in just 1 year of implementing this strategy. So we think getting principals, good principals, focused on instruction can really drive achievement and help us close the achievement gap. Both teachers and principals were a core element of what Boston did when they turned around their schools. And we think it's a great example just to highlight what the power of improving those two things can do. They invested a lot in professional development. You ask someone there and they'll say the 3 things we did were development, development, development. So how do we give teachers the skills? How do we give them common planning time? How do we give them in-classroom coaching as opposed to big auditorium presentations? They focused the principals on excellent instruction. They built the principal and teacher pipeline in terms of recruitment. They also worked aggressively to make sure the principals were up to the task and those that weren't left the district. In fact, during the 10 years of the reform, 3/4 of the principals either retired or removed or went on to other things. They also created pilot schools to be more innovative and add autonomy. So with all those things taken together, they have seen some great results. From 25% meeting the state standard to 82% in math in a 9-year time frame, and from 43% to 87% in reading in that same 9-year time frame. One size doesn't fit all was something we saw. We've seen different districts, for example, in Miami. Lower performing schools get low discretion over what they do. Higher performing schools get a lot of discretion over what they do. Chicago takes a different approach. Middle performers don't get as much autonomy, whereas the high performers are unleashed to do great things and to do more of what they know works. Low-performing schools are replaced with proven outside operators, or they restart them and give them high autonomy in order to allow them to be innovative. Now, with autonomy comes accountability. So this is, you can have this freedom, but we're going to measure you, we're going to track it, and if it's not working, we're going to change it. These are 2 things we think it's important for MPS to look at and to think about which might work best given their current situation. Another thing is high expectations, a whatever it takes culture and instructional time. These are some of the elements that some of the high-performing charter schools hold dear. And for one example, KIPP in particular, the results they have with high poverty, high diversity students are impressive. In math, from 44th to 83rd percentile in just a couple of years, and in reading from the 34th percentile to the 58th percentile. So we think these are also helpful examples to learn from. In addition, rigor drives achievement. By expecting more of students, they deliver more. It's more predictive of earning a bachelor's degree. It predicts higher test scores. Those that enter in the bottom quartile of their class do better in their rigorous coursework than in the other coursework they would have otherwise enrolled in. And students expected to master more rigorous curricula are more likely to persist and be better prepared. One quick example of this, Montgomery County, Maryland has seen results. They broadened the accessibility of the AP coursework, and you can see how the overall in the district, now 56% of the class of 06 are taking greater than one AP exam, with only 24% of that nationally. More impressively, I think, is the increase you see in the African-American and Hispanic students taking these tests. But this not only increases access, it increases achievement. When you look at how many of the class of 06 score a 3 or higher, which is the score you need to get college credit, similarly impressive results, a 5-fold increase in the number of African Americans earning a 3 or higher in Montgomery County, and a doubling of the Hispanic students earning a 3 or higher. So rigor doesn't only drive access to rigor doesn't only drive participation, but it drives success. And we think this is also a critical element. Along those lines, we also think it's important to align the curriculum from the goal of being college ready all the way back to pre-K. How do we make sure the curriculum manages those transitions from step to step to step all the way back to pre-K and doesn't let kids get lost in the shuffle? So those are the critical elements. And I think those were important for us to factor in. Taking that into account, our analysis of the situation in Minneapolis, along with what we heard from experts and our discussions amongst the strategic advisory group, we came forth with our 9 recommendations, which I'll first go through briefly and then provide more detail on each. First, restart and or bring in other high-quality schools to replace the bottom 25% and unleash high-performing schools. Raise expectations and rigor for all students, aligning pre-K through 12 programs to college readiness. Develop the principal core and give the principals the power, training, and support to lead great instructional teams. Develop teachers as leaders and give them the tools and supports they need to get excellent results. Set clear expectations for all staff throughout the district at all levels. Reward successes, and those that aren't succeeding, develop them. And if that doesn't work, find other opportunities outside of the district and remove those that aren't able to perform. Transform relationships and partner with families. This was an issue we heard loud and clear. Correct and stabilize the financial situation. Commit to supporting a network of great schools for all Minneapolis kids. And build widespread support for getting results. This is something that the district can't do alone. Seems like a lot, and it's a list of 9, but I think they hang together nicely when you think about our objective of every child college ready. 5 core strategies: rigor, principals, teachers, partnering with parents and families, and then taking aggressive action on the bottom 25 and unleashing the high-performing schools. And these core strategies are all supported by key enablers: financial stability, accountability, culture, community and government support, infrastructure. We think all of this is going to be necessary if MPS is going to reach the goal and close the achievement gap, as we hope they will. So with that, I'm going to go into each recommendation briefly, and I will maybe err on the side of going too quickly, but would certainly welcome questions and clarifications later. First, restart and or bring in other high-quality schools to replace the bottom 25%. We think that we need speed and more leadership capacity, given the gap, given the number of schools that are struggling, and I'll show you the details on that in a few moments. We need outside help to do this. We think the district should restart or replace 15 traditional schools in the next 5 years, and we think the district needs to restart or replace their contract alternative schools. This is some of the detail around the quartiles of schools in Minneapolis. You see the other schools at the bottom, these are the contract alternatives that I'm referring to, are not performing with regards to state proficiency. And there are reasons for that. There are those schools specifically serve populations that haven't been successful. So in some ways, the numbers aren't surprising, but we still clearly need to improve those numbers and find a better solution for the children in those schools. The bottom 25%, only 15% proficient in math, only 28% proficient in reading. This is something we don't think is going to change with slow, gradual improvements. We think a radical solution is needed for the bottom 25%. We think the district should create an Office of New Schools to launch sponsored charters, self-governed schools, and restart models, that they should strengthen the restart model. Restart is a word we use deliberately that needs to not only take into account what is already possible in terms of hiring staff for those schools, but needs to allow for even more flexibility along the lines of more instructional time, increased freedom on hiring practices, et cetera. So it's not business as usual in terms of restarting those schools. And we say replace for the reason I mentioned earlier. We think the district needs additional capacity to help turn these schools around, and we think finding high-quality outside partners such as charter operators with a proven track record of success is critical to getting the job done. Now, this is one of the recommendations, that one in particular, that definitely caused some discussion and some pause amongst our advisory group. In some ways, I think that's driven by not being sure. We know that charters are not a be-all and end-all solution. We know that there are a lot of charters out there that are not performing effectively. This can only be truly effective if you identify effective charters and partner with them in a way that holds them accountable the same way we expect Minneapolis Public Schools to be accountable. The other thing that's important is to provide more wraparound social services. This was another thing we discussed heavily at the Strategic Advisory Group. The kids today, especially in these poor performing schools, come to school with many different challenges, and there should be ways to work with the county and with the state to provide services on site in a way that those students will be better prepared to take advantage of the educational opportunities they have at school. We ask a lot of our teachers, and we will be asking a lot of our teachers throughout this process. At the same time, if we can provide additional services to help those children be better prepared when they enter the classroom and have a better situation in general, it will make great strides in terms of helping them learn. We also propose that restart models, some districts implement this by restarting an entire school. We propose instead that it's a phase-in, phase-out approach, where the new ninth grade is part of the new effort and the old 10th grade maintains their current approach, as opposed to closing an entire school and restarting all four grades at once. How is it different? It's more schools doing more of what works. We've also set goals for each of these recommendations because, again, we think it's important to track progress, to look at what's important, and to look at how we are doing. Our proposed goal, and these might change, but we think it's important to be this aggressive and this specific, is that by 2012, 25% of MPS students are enrolled in new MPS-sponsored charters or restarted schools, and that all new MPS-sponsored charters or restarted schools are performing in the top half of MPS schools within 3 years of launch. Secondly, we believe it's important, as I said before, to raise expectations and rigor. We know that rigor leads to higher achievement, so we think it's important to set expectations for what kids need to know, to align the curriculum with aggressive standards, to make sure that there's additional enrollment in the rigorous coursework and that that reflects the student population in Minneapolis Public Schools, and make sure every child is ready to move on to the next grade. Ultimately, smart is not what you are, it's what you do. And we need the students to understand that, we need the teachers to understand that, and we need the system to reflect that. People rise to the challenge, and we need to give all students in Minneapolis the opportunity to do that. Our goal here would be to see 50% of high-poverty students and 50% of students in color in 11th and 12th grade enrolled in one or more IB or AB courses by 2009. Thirdly, we want to develop the principal corps and give them the power, training, and support to lead instructional teams. It's second only to teachers in driving achievement. As I mentioned earlier, when principals spend time on instruction, it really does drive improvement. We recommend hiring school administrative managers to help protect that time and allow principals to do that. We want to focus training on instructional leadership, expand the pipeline of talent, evaluate and remove underperforming principals, and allow principals the opportunity to choose their own teams and make them accountable for the results at their school. This was another recommendation that was controversial, as you might imagine, especially amongst the teachers who were concerned that principals they've dealt with may not have the ability to be good instructional leaders and may not be fair or appropriate in the way they decide whether they keep or remove teachers. We certainly acknowledge that concern, and all of these things have to happen together, which is why we highlighted principals first and making sure you have effective principals leading every school. We need principals to be instructional leaders, not building managers. By 2009, we want principals to be spending almost 3/4 of their time on instruction, and we want principals to be considered highly effective by 90% of the teachers and 90% of the parents in their schools. And you'll see this theme of getting input from other stakeholders when we look at performance of our various folks in the district. Similarly, we want to develop teachers as leaders and give them the tools and support to get excellent results. We want to reallocate training dollars to focus on in-classroom coaching as opposed to big one-size-fits-all professional development. We want to create common planning time to allow them to collaborate, provide them better support for behavior and instruction strategies for key groups such as ELL and special education students. And while class size has been debated a lot, we don't think it's an across-the-board solution. We do think there are places where it would make sense to focus investment, such as bottom 25% schools or writing-intensive high school classes, for example. We think it's important to expand the pipeline of talent, and just as I said with principals, we think it's important to evaluate and remove underperforming teachers. How is this different? In order to meet this goal and close the gap, we need a teacher in every classroom who engages all students and can improve achievement by more than one grade level for every student. Just one grade level is not enough. We looked at the stats earlier. If that's what we do, kids that are 3 grades behind now will still be 3 grades behind later. We need to drive achievement by more than one grade level in every classroom. By 2009, we want 90% of our teachers to believe that professional development is an effective use of their time, and we want 90% of teachers to feel that their principals support them in raising academic achievement. Number 5 is about accountability, because you can't manage what you don't measure. We think there need to be simple, aligned scorecards at every level that the public has access to. Performance reviews should happen often and include multiple points of view. We should eliminate barriers that keep us from holding on to our top performers, and we should remove underperformers who don't improve. And this isn't singling anybody out. This is at everybody that works on behalf of and for Minneapolis Public Schools needs to be held accountable, needs to know what they need to do, be held accountable for it, given the tools to do it. And if they're not succeeding, we need to get someone who will be able to succeed in that situation. This is different, and it needs to be, given the magnitude of the change we need, because it's pinpointing concerns and making change where we need it, not just making do with what we've got. This is an example of New York that I won't get into, but they have school-by-school report cards that clearly highlight to the public how the school's doing on a couple of key measures, what the overall grade is. It's not a 15-page report. It's one page. And that's important for everybody to be able to look at, understand, and know where they stand. Number 6 is about transforming relationships and partnering with families. Again, we talked about how important that is. We want MPS staff to be culturally competent and work well with families of all backgrounds. We want to see a collaborative partnership between parents, teachers, and principals to address student needs. We want families to feel more connected, and we want to support families to help them succeed. And we need to develop trust of these families through transparent operations. There's a lot of folks distrustful of the school district at this point. We think this will be different because we think all parents will be engaged and share responsibility with their school for increasing student achievement, and we need all staff to be held accountable for inclusive family engagement. The finances are a crucial point as well. We have a $100 million shortfall, which needs to be fixed quickly. We need to seek reimbursement for unfunded mandates, for example, the special education cost that comes out of the general fund instead of the money provided to the district for that purpose. We need to look at other subsidies that occur, transportation to other schools, and investigate the effect this is having on driving the shortfall for Minneapolis. We need to improve our reporting, increase transparency, and develop a new facilities master plan. We want to make sure that financial decisions are made using an academic return on investment, not just across-the-board cuts. We need to commit to supporting a network of great schools for all Minneapolis kids. So the district should be supporting high-quality options, even if they're not Minneapolis public schools. Positive partnerships with high-quality competitors, including sharing best practices, services, and facilities where appropriate. Advocating for high-quality standards and for a level playing field between Minneapolis public schools and charters. Right now, students that leave the subsidies, things that happen, make it in the district's best interest in some ways to keep students, whereas what they should be doing is looking at what is best for this individual student. This was also something that has caused, given folks at the district as well as on our advisory group, pause, but we think it's important. Choice is here to stay. We need to work with it in a way that's really effective as opposed to playing us versus them, and focus on high quality competitors, not all the competitors. Number 9, the district needs to build widespread support for getting results. The district is committed to making tough choices, and the district knows that they need to go forward on their own and drive change, but they also know that help is needed, and that's one of the reasons we're here today. We need shared commitment within MPS. We need broader community support. We need the government partnerships, higher education partnerships, and partnering with business community and foundation to do this. This is a big task. I think we're up to it, but I think we all need to be involved to get this done. We need to move past the blame game, to a shared game plan. One other thing that the strategic advisory group talked about that I'll mention briefly, it's not a recommendation because we all decided it was too big of an issue for us to tackle, but something that should be considered, and that is governance. Many urban school districts experience frequent superintendent turnover, and when a new superintendent comes to town, that often results in new leadership teams, a totally different direction for the district. MPS has had 3 different superintendents or interims in the past 4 years, and many large urban districts like Chicago, New York, and Boston no longer have elected boards. So the Strategic Advisory Group recommends that additional exploration into this type of stability-enhancing governance model be undertaken. Again, we didn't want to get into the details, but it definitely warrants consideration. We think if we're successful, not only will we see greater achievement and the closing of the achievement gap, but that MPS will be different for everyone. Teachers will be part of outstanding teams with inspiring principal leaders who support their teaching and development. They'll have access to student data, and they'll have more planning time to make them more effective in the classroom. Principals will feel great about their instructional teams, will be able to spend more time on instruction, and will feel that 807 has been responsive to them and support their unique school needs. Parents will always feel welcome at school and will feel confident that their child's school expects the best from their students, and they'll be aware of what's going on at the school and what's going on with their student. And last but certainly not least, in fact, last but first, is students. Students will feel challenged, know that they are expected to achieve, and will believe that they can achieve. And they'll feel safe and supported in a positive school environment. Change of this size is not business as usual. We're going to need implementation scorecards. We're going to need transparency to bring the public along. We think there should be an implementation advisory board to help support the change and an implementation SWAT team to supplement the senior leadership team at 807. We also think there are opportunities to seek extra help from the broader community on issues such as finance, information technology, and communications. It's ambitious, but it needs to be. A comprehensive solution is needed, not one-off programs. We need to set a strategic direction and stick to it long enough to get results. And we know that not everybody will be happy, certainly not all the time. This is challenging. There will be a lot of tough decisions. But the goal of every child college ready, 80% proficient, closing the achievement gap, cannot be attained if we don't make some aggressive decisions. The bottom 25% is a bold strategy, and it needs to be bold in its implementation. And real reform will require sustained commitment over many years from the board, the district, and the broader community. But not only is it ambitious, we also think it's doable. We know that the leadership is willing to make tough decisions in favor of student achievement. We know that targeted initiatives are already underway, and the board and the superintendent and his team have already shown initiative on making tough calls. And we know that the broader community is interested and engaged, both from our work, from the board meetings, and from the conversations we've had. With that, I would like to thank you and spend as much time as you'd like on questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Scott. I really appreciate all the work you've done and the work that all of you, the many hours that you put into this project, the analysis, the collection of information was really amazing. I was very proud to be part of the Strategic Planning Advisory Committee. So I really commend you for the work and commend the board for the work that you've done. I would like to welcome Senator Jim Carlson is here, and I would like to open for questions. Senator Moore, do you have any questions?
I do, Madam Chair. I was wondering if you could explain to us how you arrived at the 80, 80, 75% numbers, or what took you to those kind of benchmarks, as opposed to say, how come not 80 all across the board? Or
So what we did with that was we wanted to set an ambitious goal with a time frame to it, and set it that's reachable but also aspirational. So what we looked at, for example, was the Boston results. The progress they made, it took longer, but they also started further back than Minneapolis Public Schools is. So what we did was we looked at what do we think it would take to get to the 80% number? How long would that take? 2012, we probably erred on the aggressive side, and I think that's what we need to do. It may end up being a year or two longer than that, but I think that's important. I think 80% felt like a good interim goal. Clearly, we want all of the students to be proficient on those standards, and we don't want there to be any achievement gap. To set an interim goal rather than one that's way far out, we thought 80% and closing the gap by 75% was a reasonable solution. And in fact, to reach that 80% goal, you'd have to close the achievement gap by that much.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Hey, Mr. Scott, Madam Chair, you mentioned earlier that one of your goals is to have 50% of the students taking an AP class. I guess I'm wondering, is that even appropriate? Because AP classes are, in general, thought to be advanced. I mean, that's the term, advanced placement, mm-hmm. and also college equivalent. And after you take the test and you achieve a higher than a 3, you are likely to receive college credit. Is it even appropriate to expect 50% of high school students to be able to be qualifying for these classes? In a lot of schools, it requires teacher recommendations to take AP classes. And they are supposed to be highly rigorous classes beyond a high school class.
Yes. So we do believe it's appropriate. And the reason being is that the example that we talked about, as well as the data that looks at these courses, expects rigor, but also recognizes that when students are placed in those classes, even if they may not traditionally have been expected to be appropriately placed in those classes, they rise to the challenge. They may not get 3s, they may get higher than 3s, or they may not quite get there. But the expectations of the teachers on what those kids need to do and the kids' expectations for themselves, when presented with a rigorous curriculum, as opposed to one that perhaps has been dumbed down, results in higher achievement for everybody. So even the students that enter in the bottom quartile of their high school classes, when they're taking more rigorous work, end up doing better off and learning more and doing better on test scores, general test scores, than if they had been tracked, if you will, into a class for lower performing students.
Madam Chair and Mr. Scott, do you think this will change the AP class work? In that you're going to be adding students that are below the today's AP types of students. Plus, you know, AP is they want to defend the rigor of their coursework, so they're not looking for adding a lot of students that otherwise wouldn't qualify for these, and otherwise maybe would be seeking a 1 or a 2 in the test. In their case, they want to look at keeping the distinction of an AP class high. Mm-hmm. And when we add more students into the AP class, that's going to make it tougher to teach that AP class. So it's, you know, it's automatically going to have an effect on how many teachers you're going to need, how much time you're going to need, and it will pull down those higher achieving students.
Well, when we've looked at the research, putting students into increasing the number of students, clearly there needs to be thought given to how many classes do you need, how many teachers do you need. But bringing students who wouldn't traditionally be tracked into those classes does not adversely affect
the other students in the class. The teachers still need to be rigorous. They have to have high expectations for all the students, and that effect alone makes sure that they stay on task and that all the students do better. The data doesn't suggest that the students who would have been in those classes otherwise suffer by the result of having students who traditionally wouldn't have been tracked into those classes in those classes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Scott, is this something you're guessing at, or is there some research that shows that? I don't know that we would find a teacher that would necessarily agree with that.
Well, the research we've looked at shows that, and I don't have the citation with me, but I can find it. I understand your question, and it would be one that I would have, but having looked through it, we see that the rigor does not only drive the achievement, but it doesn't bring down the other students who would have normally been in those classes. The bigger concern is having low expectations for kids and what that does to them in general and in terms of their academic performance.
Madam Chair, Mr. Scott, do you,
Senator Carlson,
do you have a goal for class sizes with this?
So I didn't spend a lot of time on it, but class size is another thing that we looked into, and the studies that have been done on that, of the 112 studies that have looked at class size, only 9 show a statistically significant positive effect of going to small classes, so going from, say, 22 students to 15. Similarly, you won't find a teacher that agrees with that either, but that's what the research shows. The research is clear to point out that class size is not a good across-the-board strategy. It's not something we'd say MPS should invest the type of money it would take to get all the classes down to, let's say, 15 students. The cost far outweighs the benefit, if any, and the research doesn't show any, except in very few cases. That being said, the research also says there may be appropriate times to have smaller classes, and I think that's something that the district and the principals and the academic team need to look at and recognize, perhaps in the more struggling schools or in certain subjects, for example, a writing-intensive high school class, they may need a smaller class. So we don't have a broad recommendation on class size, but do want to put it out there, both to say it's not a broad strategy that's cost-effective, but also it is something that should be considered on a targeted basis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Scott, and thank you, Mr. Hale. We really appreciate that you're here, and we will have more questions. We're running out of time, and we need to hear from the councils. So please stay around, because I'm sure people would like to ask you questions directly. So thanks again for your presentation. Next in the agenda, we are going to hear a presentation from the different councils, state councils, that represent different communities of color and the American Indian community. So I would like to call them to the front, please. We have the Chicano Latino Affairs Council with us today, the Council on Black Minnesotans. We have the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans and the Indian Affairs Council. So I understand the order will be Chicano Latino Affairs Council and the Indian Affairs Council. I apologize that we're running out of time. We heard some statistics and an overview of that, so if you're going to cover part of that, I would like to advise you that we spend more time on your overview rather than statistical overview. And we're going to start with you. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Rogelio Munoz. I'm the Executive Director for the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Good afternoon, Senator Torres-Rey, Madam Chair, and committee members. First and foremost, I'd like to thank you for the invitation today to present to you on behalf of the state's Latino community, but more so on behalf of 43,000 Latino students who sit in our classrooms today statewide, who share valuable experiences and perspectives with their classmates, their peers, their teachers, but more so are a testament to the cultural awareness and cultural difference and diversity that the state of Minnesota has had. In an effort to facilitate a brief conversation on the achievement gap with respect to Latino students, we prepared a very simple 5-slide presentation with valuable input and data using sources from the Minnesota Department of Education, the State Demographic Center, the Center for Rural Policy, Wilder Research, and the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership. And I know in light of what you just shared with me, not to spend too much time on data and statistics, I'll try to keep that in mind. But our presentation will include Latino student achievement data, achievement research and analysis, education and family program benchmarks, and then lastly, some conclusions in which the council has made. Yeah. First of all, well, that's not supposed to be there. Since early 2007, the council has undergone a vigorous organizational redevelopment, and part of this direction or part of this organizational redevelopment has been to execute our charter. And part of this organizational redevelopment, we've established community forums statewide. With these community forums that we've hosted statewide, we're trying to provide a platform for Latino community members as well as stakeholders so that they can voice their concerns on areas in which impact Latinos, also on areas of interest that that are most interesting to Latinos. This past summer, we hosted a series of forums in Willmar, Moorhead, Worthington, Austin, St. Cloud, and in the very near future, we're going to be in Mankato and Duluth, and obviously working our way into the Twin Cities during the legislative session. But during these community forums and visits, education and the achievement gap has been the universal issue that has sparked attention and interest of the Latino community, ranging from Latino students to principals, superintendents, and counselors. This was a key issue facing many students in our schools. Now, according to the Children's Defense Fund, there are 1.2 million children in the state of Minnesota, and out of those 1.2 million children, there are 12% that are in immigrant families. Now, while the Latino population in the state of Minnesota is 3.8, which is equivalent to 195,000 people here in the state of Minnesota, Latinos actually represent slightly more than that in our public schools, which is at 5%. As of 2005, the percentage of students of color in the state of Minnesota is 20%, and those cohorts are broken down into the African-American student population, be it at 8%, the Asian community being at 5%, as well as the Latino at 5%, and then lastly, the American Indian at 2%. Last fall of 2006, the Center for Rural Policy and Development and the Council co-sponsored a report entitled Latino Education, Latino students in our public schools. And the purpose of this report was to better understand the enrollment patterns and trends of Latino students throughout the state, to better understand the academic challenges that Latinos face in Minnesota, examine revenue sources in schools, and to also learn about programs in schools to improve retention. Now, one of the graphs that I'd like to direct your attention is the one in the upper quadrant on the upper left side. And I want to share with you that there are five academic school years here, 2001 through 2002. There's total enrollment and Latino enrollment. And within these 5 years, the state of Minnesota experienced a decline of student enrollment by 3%. However, at that same time, Minnesota saw an increase of Latino students by 38%. So that tells us that our Latino students in public schools here in Minnesota has increased, while overall the state has experienced a decline. However, while Latino students are increasing in our public schools, they're actually the cohort of students that has experienced the least amount of academic achievement and success. If I could direct your attention to the 2006 Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Tests for reading and math, you can see there, as our previous guest mentioned, about the achievement gap between non-white students and white students. And they're very appalling, as you can see. Latino student proficiency in reading, as you can see in the upper right of the slide, is barely above half. So in the third grade, there's a remarkable achievement gap between white students and Latino students. And then, as you can see, from the third grade to the 11th grade, there's a downward trend of Latino of the achievement gap, or the achievement gap actually increasing. The same thing for math. As you can see here, Latino students are barely passing in the third grade at above 50% proficiency in math. And then, again, we see a downward trend and the widening of the gap, as you can see, from third to 11th grade. The 2007 basic skills writing test is required by state for students to pass in order to graduate from a in order to graduate from high school, students have to pass their basic skills writing test. And so basically what we wanted to direct your attention to is that the overall average of passing this test is 92. However, when compared to when Latino students compared to other students of color, Latino students are actually just above the African-American students at 75%. But the overall average, as I said, is 92. White students are doing much better beyond and above the average. So that's also something that we want to address. We want to address that statistic to the committee. In addition, graduation rate, as you can see in the upper left of the slide, Latino students, while they have increased, as I said, from 2000 to 2006 by 38%, they're actually the cohort of students that are graduating least here in the state of Minnesota at 65%. The average graduation rate in Minnesota is 90%. However, as you can see, Latinos are graduating just above average. One of the issues that we want to focus our attention on is that we know that Latinos are not graduating at a rate that is favorable. We know that there is an increasing achievement gap in reading and in math. So we want to focus on the root causes of this. What can we do as a state government and schools to focus on the root causes of this? And so we list a couple, and I think there are around maybe seven. The first one is socioeconomic and environment learning. Socioeconomic being access to health care, affordable housing, the learning environment. Are parents reading to their children? How involved are their parents in their child's life and their learning environment? We have school factors and student mobility. The gentleman from the National Council of State Legislators mentioned that the rigor of curriculum in a student's educational experience needs to be above and beyond average. Student mobility, what we have recorded specifically here in the state of Minnesota is that most Latino students have a high percentage of mobility throughout the state, whether from greater Minnesota to the Twin Cities or from the Twin Cities out into rural areas or even outside of the state boundaries. Community involvement, another issue, is how involved can we get our communities involved with student academic success, having local chamber of commerces, having other businesses involved. Institutional and cultural barriers. This is one of the things that we've experienced during our community visits and forums. A lot of Latino students mentioned to us that they don't feel that they're being integrated into their educational settings because they don't have there aren't bicultural, biliterate faculty and staff. And so that's one of the issues that we'd like to focus on if we do have the opportunity to issue another report. Another root cause is race, income, and parental education, demographics, diverse origins, and educational experience. Closing the gap, we've listed a couple of recommendations there. Early childhood education, successful coaching. We visited schools that have implemented special programs to catch students up and to minimize the achievement gap. Increased partnerships between schools, districts, nonprofits, universities, the community. What we have often heard is that it takes a village to raise a child, and so that's following that philosophy. And then rigorous and challenging curriculum, smaller class sizes, and offering post-secondary education opportunities. Here in the state of Minnesota, students have the opportunity to take advanced placement courses in their educational high school experience and actually get 2 years' worth of college credit. These are just some of the school program benchmarks that we've identified. Sleepy Eye Schools, which is here in the state of Minnesota. There's currently a program in west side of St. Paul in collaboration with the Neighborhood House. There's a charter school, Academia Cesar Chavez. And then lastly, in Austin Public Schools in southern Minnesota, they've implemented success coaches to catch up Latino students with other students that are graduating from high school. It's about college readiness and offering them these opportunities. Oftentimes, these students are first-generation college students, and they don't have that access to appropriate material in which how to apply for college and things like that. Summary comments in conclusion. Minnesota is at that tipping point. We're going to experience a huge wave of retirees. And so with that, we need to be prepared that we're going to have a skilled workforce to replace these workers. And so our goal is to improve learning opportunities and expect Latino students to obtain at least 95% graduation rate by 2025. Community involvement, as I said, how involved should we have the community, county, school funding, including business, the business sector, and then school practices of mentor programs, middle and secondary schools. Some of the schools that we visited, as I said previously, have implemented programs to help Latino students catch up to the white students, and then maximize Latino student participation and learning opportunities. This is about having ESL programs that are actually adding to their cultural learning environment and other things like that. And with that, I hope I summarized what was supposed to be a 20-minute presentation into about maybe 10 minutes. So,
thank you, Mr. Munoz, and I really appreciate that you're doing this. Please remember that this is just the beginning of our conversation, and I need to let the audience know that the councils are working with my office right now to develop a memorandum of collaboration through which the state legislature will work with the councils and the ombudspersons to consult on legislation affecting children of color in the state of Minnesota. And we are very excited about this partnership, and we will continue to work and to hear from one another and to consult with one another. So I wanted to open this opportunity just for the audience to know that you are working on these issues and that you, the communities can connect directly with you to ask questions and to provide the information to your office so that you can deliver that information here. I would like to wait for questions until we complete the presentations, if that's okay with the senators. And I would like to welcome our co-chair, Senator Erickson Robes, is here. So
thank
welcome,
you, Madam
Senator.
Chair. And I appreciate you going ahead with the committee. I'm sorry that I've missed what I have, but I was at another meeting. So glad to be here.
Thank you. I would like to call now the Indian Affairs Council. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and I would like to ask you to please introduce yourselves, and we will give you some time warnings. I know that the three of you would like to speak, so we will do our best to accommodate. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Anna Marie Hill. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and I want to thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for having us address the council today on the critical issue of the achievement gap. I myself am going to say very few words. I brought with me a couple of experts who have been working in education and the issue of education and the achievement gap for a long time, and that has not been me, although I've been around the legislature for some time. So I did call upon these two individuals to assist us in bringing their vast amount of knowledge and expertise in the area of American Indian education. And I will, at this time, turn it over to them and let them introduce themselves and to speak to you directly.
Good afternoon. My name is Jackie Frederick. I am serving, my employment is as Program Director of Student Services for Robbinsdale Area Schools. I'm here at Anna Marie's invitation. I also happen to be serving as the chair of the Advisory Task Force on Minnesota Tribes and Communities and K-12 Standards Reform. You have three members of that group today, Anna Marie and I, and Elaine Salinas from Migazi Communications also serves on that task force. We will be bringing the legislature a formal report in February from that group.
Thank you, and welcome.
Hi, I'm John Pupart, President of the American Indian Policy Center.
It looks like, do you want me to go first? They've asked me to go first. I've provided to you lots and lots of data, which I will not present thankfully. Also, an electronic copy of that that you can share with your colleagues. There isn't a lot different that I would add to the information you've heard from the previous presenters. And I apologize that my PowerPoint is not working. It appears that I created it on Windows 07, and that does not appear to be the program that's on this computer. So I do have some paper copies that I've shared with the committee members. There's just a few points I would like to make about the achievement gap of American Indian students. And we know, of course, that that means that there are significant disparities between American Indian students and their white peers. One of the points I would like to make is that that gap is evident as students enter kindergarten. There is no collection of state data on that issue, so I have only a couple of things. In our school district, Robbinsdale Area Schools, we do something we call literacy assessments with every entering kindergartner. And I've been pulling the information on American Indian entering kindergarten students for a really long time. Just one sample piece of a test item is 2 years ago, when you looked at all of the entering kindergartners and you looked at all of the kids, entering kindergartners, by and large, a total of roughly 70-some percent of all entering kindergartners could name all of the 24 to 26 of the capital letters. American Indian students, of the few that were in that sample, none of them could. And there were other kinds of test items that I could bring to you to say, you know what, the gap exists when the students get to us in schools. I was at a meeting just the other day that included Brent Gish, who is the interim superintendent at Red Lake School District. One of the things that he reported is that during the current school year, only 6% of entering students were considered school ready. So we know then in public education that students, at least American Indian students, are coming to us with an achievement gap. There are things that we can do about that. And we all know what they are, and we've heard them from every presenter. We know that good school readiness programs help. We know that literacy-based childcare helps. We know that quality preschool programs help, and we know that all-day kindergarten helps. I mean, those are things you've heard and will continue to hear time and again. We have to get to the children early. We also know that the gap persists all the way through elementary grades. We know that the gap widens over time. That's concerning. I've shared with you just in my brief presentation, and it's in great detail in the bigger presentation, the information from third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade, 10th grade. You can see that gap widening between non-Indian students and American Indian students. And I would suspect that my colleagues that presented ahead of me would say, yes, this is true for Latino students. This is true for African American students. The gap widens over time. There are some strategies that can help there. We've heard about smaller class sizes. Always, maybe not. But in a good number of the cases, that would help. We talk about mobility, but there's also an issue of mobility of teachers. We hear about the need for quality professional development, and talking to our interim superintendent from Red Lake the other day, he was saying, Jackie, he said, do you know how much money Red Lake has spent over the last few years on professional development? And this year I had to replace 27 teachers. For a district the size of Red Lake, that is significant. And there's been lots and lots of teachers then, 27 teachers, who went off to other districts better prepared to serve American Indian students than the 27 replacements that he will now have to train all over again. So that mobility of teachers, as well as the mobility of students, impacts that achievement gap. In Minneapolis, for example, one of the 256 American Indian students that exist in the state of Minnesota, one of those 256 teachers is my son. In Minneapolis, as a relatively new teacher, ninth grade teacher, he has been in a different school every year for 9 years. We need American Indian teachers, and we need young men who are American Indian teachers. But it's not a nice career path when you have to go somewhere else every single year. I mean, at some point, he'll have enough seniority to settle in one place. But the kids need stability. Again, the need for culturally relevant curriculum, high-quality staff development. You've heard that. You hear relationships. Time and again, you hear relationships. Teachers who are moving all the time don't have time to build relationships with students, and you need time to do that. I've included some sample data from some school districts that I just pulled off the state website. Again, it shows the gap widens over time. I've included Robbinsdale, Redwood Falls area schools, where you see wonderfully the third grade students, American Indian students, are outperforming white students. As you get further down the grades, the gap is huge. I included Robbinsdale, Red Lake, Bemidji, Minneapolis. I won't go into that information. Again, the strategies that help, a sense of belonging, addressing issues of race, barriers to access, and instructional time. We have just a few minutes here. We have some recommendations. There are some best practice initiatives that are out there, scientifically based reading programs. We heard about, in our task force, heard about some success that Fond du Lac Ojibwe School and Net Lake were having with Success for All. Culturally relevant curriculum, the Success for the Future grants. We all know that there were 47 applicants, only 37 of them were awarded for lack of resources. The state says it has data that school districts who receive those grants do better with American Indian students than schools that don't. The World Language Programs allowed for one grant to serve indigenous languages. There are many of us who are trying to deliver language development in our tribal languages. Robbinsdale Area Schools will have a Ojibwe language class next year for students. And one last point is the need for longitudinal data. The schools in our district that we are considering beat the odd schools are using data to inform instruction. And it can't be the snapshots that we get from NCLB data. It has to be longitudinal information. And there's some recommendations about this in the larger report that hopefully you'll get copies of. But I hear that time and again. So I'm sorry to almost
thank you, Ms. Frederick. And we apologize that we have to rush you to through an important presentation. Yeah. But again, we will have more time to go through this. Welcome, Mr. Pupar.
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. And thank you for the introduction, Anna Marie. My name is John Pupart. Education, I'm not an educator, but I've been around education long enough to know that we have a problem. When I say we, I'm talking about the school system as well as the community, as well as the families and children combined. And the history of an education is long. It's within the trust of responsibility of the United States government toward the Indian people as bargained for in the treaties and in the laws that followed. These data are not new to me. The failure rate of our children in the schools has been outrageous for years, for decades. We have developed an Indian education program in 1972 at the congressional level. And the very reasons for that statute are the reasons we're in the room today. The failure to graduate, the absentee rates, the academic achievement failure rates, and the dropout rates are all a part of that piece of legislation. And I hearken back here to 1988, the Minnesota Indian Education Act used the same kind of data and information for generating the interest in Indian education as it occurred then. We had a radical idea during the process, and we said, okay, the Indian tribes in Minnesota would take command of all the dollars that are coming into the state or from the state for Indian education. We would establish an American Indian School Board statewide, and that we would do what education was failing to do over the years. It scared a few folks, but we did get some results. There's now a school on the east side of St. Paul, Indian Magnet School. There's a Anishinaabe Academy following from Four Winds in Minneapolis. There was an Indian school in Duluth that followed. Three pieces that came out of that legislation, although that was not the intent of the legislation, but it moved people to respond. But we let it go there, and we seem to have reached the doldrums again, and we're talking about the achievement gap again. Well, we have a great need here, and it doesn't belong only to the Indian people. It doesn't belong only to Indian tribal governments or Indian communities. It's a part of the problem belongs within education itself, where we cannot function just on the periphery of education or as an add-on, as a class where our children are pulled from the routine of the classroom and the curriculum to attend in an education. It has to be a part of the curriculum. And we've got many, many fine Indian educators, and I applaud them for their commitment, for their work that they did in developing their careers and the workplace around them that would be knowledgeable and sensitive about Indian education. But this is a structural issue as well as a process. Structure of Indian structure of education has not been accommodating for our culture, for our native culture, and that's what drives us. That's what turns us on. That's what entices us to delve into the studies. We don't have that quality within education. It isn't there. And in the planning process and the development of programs and budgets and strategies, etc., there isn't an access point where that can occur. Until that occurs, we're going to be back here visiting again and again and again. Now, I'm really tired of admiring the problem because this cannot go on any longer in my lifetime, which isn't too much longer. But I see that we need to have education as an institution own this as a problem, and in owning it, to reach out and to connect with families, children, and community to really make this a cyclical kind of activity, which is reflective of Native worldview, that we live with the circle and we handle matters in our community with the circle, no matter what it is. Where do you think your sentencing circles come from, or your dispute resolution circles? These are an adaptation of Native style, and we need to get at that so it can be a part of the process. And we have a lot of partnerships going on with school and community, but they're really not a part of the curriculum development, any program. And we seem to think that if we hire Indians that this will change. Well, there's 114 Indians living in, not living, but working in the St. Paul School District. Why do we have the issues with the St. Paul School District if hiring Indians is going to be the answer to the problem? There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done, but we need to put on our thinking a little bit differently. We need to be a little more innovative. And being innovative doesn't mean that the Indian folks are going to come up with a new idea. They're just going to bring you the old ideas, and we can introduce folks to them, and together we can work on this issue. But we have to have willing partners. We have to have authentic collaboration. We have to see what's in this for all of us, not just from time to time. This is a issue that remains with all of us. And we've done a wonderful job of developing higher education for Indian people. But those tribal colleges, higher education, are not getting the numbers and the volumes of Indian students that they ought to. So with that, I'm going to close. And some of you have heard this before, but I've been saying it for 25 years, so you might have heard it before. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Papart. We really appreciate your patience and also that you are continuing to deliver this message and don't get tired. So thank you. I know that Ms. Hill requested that we have questions now because Ms. Frederick needs to go because she's traveling. So I'm going to ask the senators that if they have questions for the Indian Affairs Council that you proceed. Senator Sharon. Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for coming to present. I appreciate you kind of zipping through this presentation. I think you're correct. We've gotten the same sort of information so many times over the years in different ways. But I'll ask in advance, I guess, for your forgiveness of, I mean, perhaps not understanding the individual challenges that the Native American community faces in terms of education. But, you know, I'm listening to your testimony, and we're talking about best practice initiatives and some of the tribal-based language programs that exist and the charter schools that are out there, and yet there's still an achievement gap. And can you help me understand even a little bit more, sir, what you're talking about in terms of needing to bring tribal understanding or the concept of the circle into improvement. Mm-hmm. What else can we do to help address the achievement gap?
Senator Ropes, what I'm talking about is, simply put, old wine in new bottles. It says that education has taken a rigid stand over the years in that Indian people who participate in that must play by those rules, must conform to its certification process, its authorizing process. To bring something new in and have it peer validated, it's kind of like the research we do. So when we use terms like evidence-based or scientific-based, they lack the content of the cultural piece of Native life. And that's really where the Indian child is at. That's an identity. If we can hook to that identity and help make a person proud of who they are, know where they came from, they certainly will join us in knowing where we're going. That's simply the best way that I can put it. It is really cultural in large part.
Okay. So what you're saying is the mechanism that's been created and the goals are all, maybe we'd say, you know, traditionally middle-class, white American sorts of goals, and it does not include your identity issues and things that, as a culture, you value in even in creating the construct.
Right. We went through a period of boarding school days when many of our people were shipped away. This was the first concept of busing, by the way, hundreds and thousands of miles away from home. And in that process was to de-Indianize us, to use a term. And it failed. It failed miserably, but we were the victims of it. And we are still trying to overcome many of those implications to this day. So they kept us from the language, from the dress, from our song, from our customs, and tried to make us something else other than what we were.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Ms. Hill has a comment.
Oh. Senator, if I could just briefly answer that question to Senator Erickson Ropes. Last year we had legislation passed in the state of Minnesota that mandates the department to take a look at the contributions of the American Indian tribes and communities in the revision and review process of the academic standards. But at that, you know, although that sounds like it's good language, that just takes mandates them to take a look at the contributions of the American Indian communities and tribes, and doesn't mandate them to put in place any of the curriculum that would speak to that identity of the American Indian communities and tribes. So I'm not sure exactly how the process is going. I think it is underway right now for one of the standards, the art standards.
The art standards are currently under revision. We do have an American Indian person on the revision committee. Jamie Edwards from the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe is serving on that committee. They have currently revised their standards and benchmarks that it does include language about the contributions of Minnesota tribes and communities. They're asking for public input during this week or so. I mean, this is their public input time. I showed the revised standards to our school district art coordinator, and he said, "Jackie, this is wonderful. I think it should be done. Our teachers won't know how to do it." Mm-hmm. And so we will need to get some resources and technical assistance out to school districts in order to enable them to carry out those provisions to the extent that they're done.
Okay. Thank you. That was helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to pass the gavel to Senator Erickson Ropes, and she will continue the meeting. Next, we don't have really a clear understanding. I think we have the Council of Black Minnesotans coming next. Please, Mr. Collins, and then we'll have Asian Pacific Council. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and looks like you have something to pass out, and then you can introduce yourselves for the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Lester Collins, and I am the Executive Director of the State Council on Black Minnesotans. And Roger Banks, who is the Research Analyst for the Council, is also with me. Somehow, Roger, in his wisdom, he doesn't know I'm going to say this, anticipated that a long statistical briefing or whatever we wouldn't have time, you know, for it, and that others would cover it and do a very good job at having done it. Given the time that we do have, and as Senator Ray has kind of brought to our attention, this is the beginning of, you know, of other discussions. So we will attempt, or at least I will attempt, to share with you just very briefly some concerns that we have. The reason why I gave you two things, number one, our biennial report, which has an education section in it, as we continue to have it as a key focus. I wish I could tell you real quickly, I think page 14 or so kind of contains some of the educational activities of the council as it continues into and through this year. Also, I kind of gave you what was a statewide King celebration report that we did. It's not really a report, it's actually our brochure. The topic was education last year. It will be education this year. And it's just interesting. I wish I had been as thoughtful as to bring you some of the themes that we were looking at, but I can tell you that I can recall that one of them in a meeting that we just had was, I think it was education, the American dream, or public crises. It was one of the, you know, just the topics among many. I can't remember what we decided on. I know it had something to do with the mind as a treasure and the whole idea of kind of tapping it. I say that to say that I invite all of you to be a part of that celebration January 21st, which again will focus on the importance of education as it relates to King and perhaps his concern as it relates to society, et cetera. One of the things that I want to do, and Roger, you were, well, very correct as it relates to the whole statistics and everything else that have presented. It would have been very, I guess, redundant for us to have attempted to do so. In his wisdom, he convinced me not to do that, at least at this particular point. I do want to share with you real quickly something that I wrote in our last King brochure. And I wrote one of the basic challenges facing parents of color. In fact, all parents is to help their children develop in a way that will equip them to function well as individuals, as family members, and as citizens. Parents are more able and willing when they have a sense of ownership in the larger society. This sense of belonging can only be felt when the rights of parents are protected and obstacles to earning a respectable living are not placed in their way. As I skip down, one of the other things I say is that somehow we must all become students who see all humanity as brothers and sisters. We must all become students whose hearts are as well educated as their minds. I'm convinced and concerned that not only is there a achievement gap, and we've had presentations that have spoken well to them, but I'm also convinced that we need to do something different as it relates to not only the minds, but the hearts, you know, of our children and perhaps ourselves. And today, I guess what I want to say to you, and I think the Chicano Latino director specifically kind of spoke, as I recall, to the many things that were presented today, is the whole, as much as we hear it, village concept. And one of the things that I'll steal from Roger that we, as we discussed our preparation today in terms of coming here, is that it is going to take a village. Our foundations is going to take you, the legislature. It's going to take our business, you know, community. And we are going to have to approach this thing more holistically and not in the kind of silos that we have done, both in terms of funding and in other areas. Let me, as I skip down, one of the things I wrote, it says that we must remember that intelligence is not enough. Intelligence plus character is the goal of true education. The complete education gives one not only the power of concentration of worthy objectives, but upon which to concentrate. The whole point being is that we have, in my opinion, we just went to an African-American conference that was held over the weekend. And I'm convinced, as has been presented today, that all children can learn. I can definitely tell you that as I sit here now, the things that I've heard today, and I am a product of what was the Upward Bound program. I had not read a book, had no interest in reading a book until I was about, I think it was the 10th grade. And believe it or not, the book that I read was called, a book by a gentleman by the name of A.S. Nill, A Radical Approach to Child Rearing. The book was about, had to be 150, 200 pages. It was in the Upward Bound program that I was in. I read it, got through it, understood it, and my life changed remarkably, I think, based on just the students I was around, the individuals that I was, you know, with. And I must tell you that I have certainly been reading ever since that point. But let me also share with you that one important ingredient in that whole experience for me is when I discovered, the contributions that African people had made, you know, to this nation, this country, and that indeed we were kings and queens and the many inventions. And if we had had more time, if I were to run through not only the contributions that African Americans have made, but others, but this, the inventions, I mean, including the lights that we look at. So as much as we hear about Thomas Edison, the filament in terms of making it, being able to last, and the fact that we're sitting in this room was a gentleman by the name of Lambert, who was an assistant to Thomas Edison, so probably has much contribution to the invention, but was not as well made known. Our stop sign, the shoes that you have on, the comb that you use, et cetera, are things that speak to the possibility and what we as a society in terms of technology, even the involvement in terms of IBM, in terms of your computer. I mean, you know, individuals, a black man. I mean, but you don't hear those things. Our children need to know these things. They need to be able to tangibly know that indeed they can achieve. Now, they don't all achieve or learn as we've learned today in the same way. So we need to challenge them in very different ways. And among the recommendations, which are many, I bought a book, and I know we're limited for time, so I'm going to resist that temptation and just tell you that we as a council and as councils are here as aids to you as we address this issue. There have been so many groups, so many reports, and I even left them. I mean, you know, today as I began to look at them, and I told Roger, I said, you know, you're right, man. I mean, this thing, goodness, has been so studied and looked at in terms of the achievement gap, and I mean no harm in terms, but we know essentially what the challenge is. There have been many recommendations here today. We need to look at, you know, issues of, number one, you know, language, those kinds of barriers. We need to look at, indeed, I believe, more teachers of color, but even more importantly, we need to retain them. There need to be more individuals who are male, you know, who are in our classrooms and at very, you know, early points. There needs to be greater student, or I really meant to say parent involvement. One thing that my children, I have two, but I also raised about 12 others in terms of foster care. And the one thing that they did, and I think that we must do, is that I never made a trip, never went to school without bringing their friends whose parents may not have been involved because of any number of reasons. Many of them have had bad experiences within the education system themselves. So they have fear or very little faith in what can be done. We must become, and I believe very strongly in the concept of not only mentors but navigators. We're going to have to take individuals, our children and parents, I think in many cases by the hand, and lead them, give them greater confidence, and help them. And we've had more than enough presentations in terms of how important and what must happen at many levels in terms of principals, teachers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, based on time, I'm going to stop, you know, regardless of the temptation to continue and to give the good gentleman here from Kentucky, no, from a chance to speak. So,
well, thank you, Lester, and Madam Chairperson and committee members. I'd just like to address myself to a couple of things. First of all, everybody's mentioned it today, and that is that it takes a village. And now we have to define the village. And then we have to have a infrastructure that allows us to, in a meaningful way, incorporate and involve the village. One of the major problems that we face today is the silo that so many of our institutions seem to perpetuate. And that oftentimes is based on a function of fear. What I'm suggesting essentially is that there are models out there that can be used effectively to deal with this issue. Models that will, in essence, allow us to identify the key stakeholders and involve them. And not only involve them, but put their feet to the fire in terms of laying out what their expectations are and then holding them to achieving those and measuring the extent to which those particular objectives have been achieved. And so what I'm suggesting essentially is that there is a community benefits agreement approach that has been used and is being used nationally. It's been used essentially as an economic development mechanism. It can be used to deal with issues much like the achievement gap, anything in education, health disparities, or whatever. And so what I'm suggesting essentially is that this committee may want to look at that as a mechanism for providing an overview, a infrastructure for, and a mechanism to assist us in moving forward. Because we could sit here all day and listen to all these lovely statistics, et cetera. I love statistics. I mean, you know, that's me. You reach a certain point when you say, hell, you know, I've heard that. I heard it last week. Heard it, you know, and we really need to move forward. But in order to move forward, we need some kind of construct, some kind of theoretical base, some kind of model that will assist us in a heuristic fashion to deal with the kinds of issues that we need to deal with. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee for these gentlemen before they leave? Okay, well, thank you so very much. Next, we'll move on to the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And sitting with me today is Melanie Herr, and she's an intern at my office. And I brought her here today because she's a student, and I wanted to be a good mentor to her and show her the process, but also to provide, which is very important, students an opportunity to voice, because they can give us a huge clue as why there is achievement gap. And many times, we do not listen to them. I come before you bringing a different perspective, and that is that I concede the fact that there is an achievement gap. Data over the years show it again and again and again and again. Asian students, although we are considered the model minority, I have some friends who are in suburban schools, and when they see an Asian student coming into their school, they're like, oh, thank goodness it's an Asian student. You know, because Asian students do well. Asian students are good in math. Asian students will bring up some of the scores maybe, instead of a refugee student who, you know, oh, they're going to so much resources, this and that. We don't have ESL teachers. We don't have resources. They're going to drain us. The attitude from the system directed towards our students is a big part of why there is an achievement gap. And so I can see to you that there is a gap. But my question to you is, why? Why is there an achievement gap? And I miss organizations such as the Urban Coalition, which did great metro-wide studies as to why there isn't. They provided the data and the concept and the construct behind that, and now we don't have that organization. And so we have gaps coming from the national level, which is studies coming from the national level, which is great. Mind the gap. The National Conference of State Legislators, they have a great report. But at the local level, and what makes sense in Minnesota to Minnesotans, you know, we need to look at that. And so, as a recommendation, I would push for this committee and this legislature to fund research that is based in the community and allow us a piece of the pie and a seat at the table to bring the issue forward and to work on the issue. Because a lot of the stuff that I heard today is coming from systems. This is what the city is going to do. This is what the school board is going to do. This is what the district's going to do. But you know what? Parents are smart. Parents may not. And I talk to parents. They don't see these numbers. They don't see these statistics. They don't know. But you know what parents tell me? How come my child went to 12 years of school, graduated, can't do nothing, can't get employed, can't talk to me about relevant issue, can't think critically? Parents know that the system is not working for their children. And I would never forget a mother coming forward and talking to me and saying, Eileen, in China, our kids are the top-rated students. In Japan, Asian students are doing so well. They are the envy of the world. You know, Japanese students up there performing great in every indicator. How come the Asian American-born students, how come we're failing? What is it within the system that is allowing our children to fail? I cannot answer that question for you. There is no research on that. However, a good point that I would point out from the National Conference of State Legislature in a study that they did that you didn't get to do today is that a lot of times we have to defend why our students are not doing well. And we have to show you so much data, so much statistics, instead of you just believing us. The fact is that students say, if there's an Asian student in school, I feel better about the school. I feel like I'm empowered. I feel like I can do better. And one of your research showed that just by having a Hispanic teacher in a school, Hispanic students do achieve at a higher rate. But instead, we're forced to say, okay, this teacher can work with the kids. But just the fact that a teacher of color is there within the school, students feel empowered that they can do well. And in fact, they actually do better. But those statistics are, you can say, oh, it only works for the Latino community and the Asian community, we don't have that research yet. So we can't quote that as a working model within the Asian community. So I'm like, okay, fund the research for that. So we can say that, you know, 5 years from now, we can come back to you and say, we did the research. It proves that if you have an Asian teacher in the school, Asian students, even if they have a class with that teacher or not, will do much better. So coming from the community perspective is that they want to be a part of the solution. They see that it's not working. And you know what? It impacts them. It impacts their, just by graduating from high school, tremendous income potential and hiring potential. And I will just give you a fact from the Asian community, for the Asian community, the Hmong community in particular, over 80% of our adults don't have a high school diploma. Just by that statistic alone, that if they could go back, spend 2 months getting a GED equivalent, that they will improve their income potential. They don't get that message. We get that message because we look at the data and we sit and we make policy. So I ask you, as a state legislature, who public education is your responsibility? It is one of your charge. A lot of times, government doesn't have the answer. For public education, the expectation is government does have the answer. And government must provide the leadership to this answer. So getting the community involved, finding out how, and getting this information to the community, getting them vested because they see the results. And my interest here is that we do work with the community. We do see that students are not doing well. And we want to know why. But right now, we don't even know why. There's not even research into the Asian community as to why students aren't doing well. So we can't even prioritize. The community is so spread out. Maybe it's gang prevention. Maybe it's truancy prevention. Maybe it's pregnancy prevention so that kids can stay in school. Community-specific data is sorely lacking. And if that's one positive thing that this legislature can do in the next couple of years, and I give that an example, is that right now we are working very actively with the Minnesota Department of Education on the dropout prevention rate, and they're collecting data. And they got this huge federal grant, and our community is not seeing a single dollar of that. But you know what? They've asked the council, us, to go into the schools and talk to the students, the Asian students, because they cannot do that. They do not have the trust and credibility to do that. And you know what? I send my staff, we're willing to do that, but we're not being paid, we're not being compensated for that. And I was like, we want a piece of that pie. We want to be part of the solution and a part of the work. And then I will turn it over to Melanie, who has actually gone and done some focus groups with the students. And so she will share to you, from the students' perspective, what they're experiencing. Melanie?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melanie Hugh, and I am with the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And it is my pleasure to bring forth some stories to you today to give you a better detailed idea of what these students are experiencing in their schools and in their home. David Zander and I had the opportunity to convene and conduct 3 focus groups in 2 high schools in North Minneapolis. And in total, 45 Hmong and Lao high school students participated in this research. The gender ratio was fairly even, 23 females and 22 males, and about 8 students from North Community High were newcomers. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to try and touch on some key themes that we found with the challenges that these students were experiencing. Social challenges. One is their experiences with peer groups. A lot of these students are not connected to the right peers in their communities, and so they're falling away from peers that are going to be able to support them. We had the pleasure of meeting with Asian clubs, and when we asked them, why is it that you want to stay in school, these students provided so many wonderful aspirations. One in particular was... Let me find it here. One in particular was that he wanted to be a doctor. This is why he wanted to stay in school. And when he said this, the classroom roared. And to have that support be behind you, that's an amazing feeling. Another thing is the relationships with teachers. We had one student, she is 17, and she's a troubled child. She's dropped out of school twice. And she explained how in the schools, she's been associated with many high school teachers, and yet it was only one teacher that embraced her, one teacher that stood by her. And she felt that there needs to be more emotional support, more support for these students, and so that they don't feel neglected. Another thing is cultural challenges. A lot of young girls are still getting married at a young age. And so we have single mothers that are either going through a divorce or are in an abusive relationship. And something that I learned is that their husbands don't let them go to school because they fear that if their wives become educated, they're going to leave them. And that's something that we have to look at. Another thing is language barrier. We forget about the newcomers that have come to the U.S. and are living here, and yet the school system hasn't structured the classrooms in a way that will allow these students to achieve their learning goals. They're being placed in classrooms where all the other students are understanding the language and understanding the material, and they're far behind. And so there's no direction for them, and they continuously fail each year, and they're frustrated. And what do we do about that? How do we encourage them to continue coming? And what about translators? Why aren't there translators available to these students? Another thing is the programs at schools. Are we providing enough social support for these students emotionally so that they can feel that they belong, because they are having an identity crisis? They go from one institution, which is the school, to another, which is the home, culture expectations there, and then they have to be a different person at the school, and they have to compromise that. How are they dealing with this? And so with that, I just, again, wanted to emphasize on the language barrier. Truly, that was something that really hit home with me, being able to meet with these newcomers. And what we heard was that there's hope. They want to learn. They want to be in the classrooms, and they want to be among their peers. But how is their hope being nurtured? Is it being nurtured? And how can we make that happen? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I do want to close that I think public education, we need transformation. It needs to not be business as usual, but we need to change it. And I would like to just disagree a little bit with the McKinsey group with regards to the goal of having all students be college ready. That is the goal of mainstream mindset. But with Asian parents, the goal of education is to get their kids a job, whether it's through college or community college or a technical program. That is how they see success in America, that education is valuable because it equals a good job, good income. How do we make that real for families? And how do the public schools make that real for the families? That will require transformation of what we teach in school and the goal and the purpose of even public education in and of itself. So I think a good example is, and St. Paul Public Schools doing this, is the apprenticeship program. Getting kids in senior school already into job training program so that they don't waste a year of high school and then 2-3 years after high school, so that they get trained already while they're in high school. You don't lose them through the college application or that summer rate, and that kids are motivated before high school, that they are. This is what they're bound for, that there are many, many tracks and there are many, many ways to do about it. But we need to get the buy-in from the community and help the community to realize its goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. I would like to inform the audience, and particularly the councils, I am going to consult this with my co-chair. I have received a number of emails from different constituency groups, but particularly from communities of color and American Indian advocates that are strongly advocating for moving into action, and they are suggesting that I draft legislation rather than hear and contemplate the problem. And I believe that you said that again today. So I hear from all of you your frustration, and I appreciate that you're patient and that you continue to come and that you continue to deliver the message on behalf of our children. We need your voice. But I do need to hear your voice, and I will consult with the members of the committee and to see as to how relevant and how important it is to continue to hear and rehearse and review statistics that we have reviewed for a number of years. They, members of the community, did share with me the reports from the Urban Coalition that are very extensive that you referred to and that Mr. Collins also referred to. And I also received some information from the Headwaters Foundation that shared information related to achievement gap. I also have multiple reports from the Department of Education that have been shared with me. Mr. Valverde has shared with me information from multiple states, and he continues to do the analysis for Minnesota. I now have the information from the Itasca group, and I have also received information from the Itasca group, and I now have the information from the McKenzie group. So, Mr. Collins, you say you have a few boxes in your office. I'd like to let you know that I have now a few as well, because people are making sure that I review the information and make sure that I don't reinvent the wheel. So I will not do that. And I will consult. I just want to let you know that I intend to consult with the members of the committee to see where do we go from here, to see if we need to have two more hearings. The intent was to have four hearings on this issue, but we need now to review the next steps. Any comments from the senators?
Well, Madam Chair, I would just add that generally when I am looking at a problem and trying to find a solution, the approach I like best is the stakeholder approach, which I think I'm hearing very clearly from the people testifying today. And that is, before you come up with a solution and then foist it off on other people, it's probably a good idea to not only hear from them and then go back and write it up, but include them in writing it up. So I would just recommend to the senator, and I'm sure you already have this in mind, that as we go forward with writing any kind of legislation, that it's not simply a result of having passively heard your testimony, but that we do get people around the table in a working session to put some of these ideas on paper together, because that in my mind is really the only way to move forward. And frankly, sometimes that's much more difficult than just a small group of people sitting down and coming up with a bill or a legislation or a school district policy or you know, whatever it is that you're talking about. But having made that mistake in the past myself, you know, all good intentions aside, you can come up with a great policy and then try to roll it out and it doesn't fit. Or it fits, you know, three-quarters of the people and a quarter of the people hate it. I'm really convinced that even though you really have to struggle in meetings going back and forth and you know, trying to find consensus, that is, in fact, what gets you a much better policy. Because part of it's just practical. You know, in terms of us, if we put our own little belt together and then we go, you know, drop it in into the process and we're arguing it, you know, before assorted committees, either get the resistance when you're writing the bill and do some struggling and get to consensus, or you're going to do it out there anyway. So, and sometimes all you do is just aggravate people by not including them. So, and put people through a lot of, you know, disappointment and unnecessary struggles, I think, trying to get to a solution. So, Senator, that would be my recommendation, and Senator Carlson as well, and other committee members, that when we get together and try to find out what the solution is and what Minnesota should be looking at in terms of dealing with the healthcare meetings all day, education, dealing with the achievement gap, that we go through this together, we write it together, and then we move forward together.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Erickson Rose. Senator Carlson, any comments?
I only have a couple of comments that, excuse me, Madam Chair, I only have a couple of comments that really echo the same thing Senator Erickson Rolps said, and in fact they echo it so much that I would have made the same error in the healthcare gap also, because that's what I've been hearing the last couple of days. Yesterday I went to a forum on the healthcare gap, and the same issues seem to be coming up over and over, where there are some major problems here that are going to require a cultural change. And I'm not ready to exactly articulate everything that I'm thinking here yet, but we are entering an experiment here of a cultural change that I don't think we can order a solution. I think we have to all work at a solution and figure out a solution together. And in fact, I think the only thing we can do is provide some votes for your solution. Your solution is something that we're going to have to accept. And you know, like I say, there's a cultural change happening here in America that no other country has ever experienced. And this is something we're plowing a lot of new ground here. And to fix these education gaps, social gaps, healthcare gaps, you name it, there's a lot of thinking that's going to have to happen here. And I really appreciate hearing a lot of your perspectives on it. And I'm looking forward to being able to work on it. And I think you made the right statement there that we don't have a lot of time. This is something that I think we need to get cracking with. And I think it's a very important issue across the country and across every issue that's going on in this country. So I appreciate you being here. Appreciate your sharing.
Thank you, Senators. With this, we're going to finish this hearing, and we will announce the plans for next steps, whether we have two more hearings to gather information, or we present some preliminary recommendations for policy proposals that we may present to the legislature this year. Thank you so much for coming, and please contact our offices, contact me. I must say that there is an issue that comes back again and again for which I don't hear a lot of controversy, as I will hear for perhaps class size, parent participation, teacher quality. There seems to be, every time we talk about any of these issues, I receive a paper or a book or a comment that says one thing, and then, boom, I receive the other one that says the opposite. But there's one that I never receive the opposite, and that is investing in early childhood education. There is a lot of consistency in the message that I get with respect to investing in early childhood education to deal with the achievement gap. So I just want to share that with you, that I am not surprised, but I'm just amazed to see the consistency in the message around investing in early childhood. So thank you, and we will post the information for next meetings. We're now adjourned.